quickie question.
This thing just so I know.
All right, before I make my final comment, why don't the person with the quick question go first?
Okay, that was N2 Moon Bounce. Go ahead, Barry. Okay, a dipole. I think, if I got it right, a dipole runs high current in the center and high voltage at the ends. Is there any difference in the radiation? I've been beating this around for a long time. In other words, does it tend to radiate better from the high voltage place or from the high current place, or does it make no difference?
John and I and Glenn, over the last 3 weeks, have been slowly deriving what we believe is a slightly modified model. Turns out almost everything you do in science consists of a model, and the model fits most of your measured experience. And I am questioning a TEM wave. Does it really contain any significant amount of E? When you study any of the very well-respected antenna modeling programs, or things like a high-frequency structure simulator, or I can't think of the name of the other one. There's one that's more time domain than frequency domain. CST Studio, I think it is. Anyhow, you study any of these programs and figure out, how do they figure out what is the radiated signal like, what the internal mechanism of the program really does, is it does a whole lot of finite element analysis. That's a fancy way of saying it breaks it up into a whole bunch of little bitty triangles. Through a very repetitive process, it calculates the exact amount of current in each individual triangle. It then says, okay, the current flowing through that little bit of triangle creates this amount of magnetic field, and at my point of observation, which might be a mile away, what does that little point of magnetic field look like? And it does that, let's assume it breaks it up into 5,000 little pieces. It calculates the amount of current in each one of the 5,000 pieces, the amount of magnetic field of each one of those 5,000 pieces, the amount of magnetic field that's received a mile away, and a mile away it adds up 5,000 magnetic fields. That's what it does. It doesn't calculate voltage. When it comes to radiated magnetic field, it is my belief that most of the programs, when it comes to, radiated electromagnetic field.
Repeater. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
So I'm led to believe that all of these programs calculate magnetic field as a method of initiating the signal to get launched into space. And the model that the three of us are coming up with seems to support that. And I'm going to be showing you another piece of evidence that came to me this week. So, I know of a kind of antenna that launches what I believe is a pure magnetic field. It launches almost no electric field, and yet it radiates like a charm with nearly 100% efficiency. On top of that, you take the so-called crest field antenna, the CFA, or it's also called the EH antenna, which was very popular and controversial starting in around 1986. A bunch of patents were issued. This was supposed to be a broadcast antenna that had the philosophy that if you separately generate the E field and separately generate the H field within an antenna, that you can build a smaller antenna with higher efficiency with greater bandwidth. Great sounding concept. A number of people built them. A couple of broadcast stations over there in Asia were talked into building one. The results are very disappointing. So I'm led to believe it's mostly magnetic fields. We're slowly going in that direction, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
My final comments. I wish to thank you, Dick, and everybody.
I guess that insurance nothing. Got it. Okay. Back to that, Dick. I'm sorry to interrupt. Thank you very much. Got my answer.
Radiation issue. My antenna's doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. I got a well-shielded system, and my electrical system is doing exactly what it should be doing because it is not a shielded system. It's a plain two pieces of wire. So therefore, it's acting like an antenna. And I happen to have a susceptible TV, but this UPS filtering system, which was suggested to me, seems to be working. It's a Band-Aid, but I'm going to, in my spare time, continue to investigate the situation. I wish to thank you and everybody on AttackNet for helping along with this situation, and I hope it helps somebody else out in a similar situation. KD2AMZ.
What exactly does the TV do?
It goes crazy. The touch controls, it changes channels, turns on and off, changes mode, does all kinds of crazy things as if some mad person is touching the touch controls.
Okay, and I believe, I'm sorry, Dick, I just want to thank you for a second. I believe somebody tells you to, did you try a UPS just to isolate the RF? Because I've seen that problem. There's a solution for it.
I did try the UPS. I went out and bought a cheap UPS last night, and it seems to be working fine.
It's about trying to prove that it comes up the line bulb.
Okay, that's exactly what we were speculating last week, that the line voltage was doing it, particularly when he would take his field strength meter and walk around the house, and as he holds it near each one of the outlets, he got a significant deflection. So hot RF line looks like it is an aggravating factor. Okay, let's go over to the mailbag, John. KC2WGB, go right ahead. K2LAW and the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Okay. Let's see. What did I discuss with you last night? Oh, yes. I have a young ham, 17 years old, in New Jersey, who built an apartment antenna. Let me let it drop. What he did was he took a window or a ledge mount, flagpole mount, and it comes out at 45. He screwed that through a window. He took a broomstick, about 6 feet long, and he put two roughly 19-inch elements on it to make a half-wave, two-meter dipole. Ran the coax down, and he developed it a little further. It works fine. He's getting great results with it. Now he has put a little universal joint on the end where the antenna is so that he could correct for any angle he wants. He can change polarities, and he can get a lot of different angles, and he's having great success with it. And he's heard our discussions with people in apartments, you know, with it on the refrigerator, on air conditioners, and he just wanted to let you know that this is the things people should try. It's very simple to build, cost them almost nothing. So maybe you have some added comments on that, Dick.
Yes, I do. And Glenn and I were discussing this a little bit last night. First of all, I think it's a very crafty idea. On VHF frequencies in particular, anytime you put the antenna outside of the house, you almost always get higher performance. Your house, the brick, the wallboard, the concrete, all of these materials in the house are partially attenuating substances on VHF frequencies for sure. So any method of putting the antenna outside the house usually is going to give you better performance. He's got an antenna where he hasn't made a great big investment in dollars. He's built it with his own hands. That's kind of fun. He can brag about it, and he should. Each night he can take it back down so that the landlord, maybe the landlord is even against flagpoles being mounted on the second floor of the house coming out of a window, so he can take it down each night and the landlord doesn't see it the next day. So when he's doing his operating each night, he can set it up when he needs it. And now with his steering mechanism where he can adjust the angle and polarization, he can have a lot of fun with this thing. And I guess in his particular apartment, let me drop. His particular apartment has windows that aim to the south and windows that aim to the east. There's something to be said about putting another flagpole mount alongside of one of the other windows so that sometimes he sets it up out the eastern window and sometimes he sets it out the south window. And because of the blockage of the building and other repeaters and other locations, he can talk to other people with less signal and a stronger signal to the repeater with less transmitter power, so to speak. So you could call it a pair of quarter wave ground planes back to back, or you could call it a dipole. And in the ideal world, you'd have some kind of a balancing device where he feeds the dipole if he's feeding it with coax, but that's not a showstopper. Ideally, it should have a balancing device, but it will work without it. And it sounds to me like it's working very well. So I think your writer should definitely consider writing this one up, Glenn, and John. It sounds like a very effective antenna. Hints and Kinks of QST Magazine would like it, and if he's willing to go through the whole construction procedure with pictures, I think there's a moderately good chance they would accept it as an article. So as a relatively young new ham to this early in life get an article published in QST would be kind of fun. I think it's worth trying. KC2 QIQ, here we go. KC2 WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
WGB. Yes, Dick, I dashed him off a little email that he should try to do that, and I told him if he gets it ready to let me know, and I would check with you to find out who he should send it to. So we'll take that down the log if he wants to do that. Okay, let me pick another one. Let me let it drop.
John, so please repeat your question. I heard you beautifully on the input, but I don't think anyone else did.
Okay, no problem. This gentleman has two antennas, a 2-meter and a 440. He wants to combine them together with one coax cable. He wants to know, can he just use a simple T connection? How should he go about it? Can he tie them in directly? He believes that it'll seek the correct antenna just by the frequency, but maybe you could give him some better ideas. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
That's a fairly common problem, and there's a whole lot of solutions. Depending on the design of the antenna, if, for instance, it was a folded dipole-driven element on the antenna, which I'm wondering why I'm hearing this. If I turn off the speech processor, my voice sounds a little bit more normal than when I turn on the speech processor. I'll leave it on for the time being. People can make a comment as to which sounds the best of them. If you're using a folded dipole feed, for instance, on the 440 antenna, when you feed 2 meters into that, it is nearly a short circuit. If there is a quarter wavelength of cable on 2 meters between the 440 antenna and a T connector, the nice thing about a quarter wavelength of cable, it becomes an impedance inverter. Because the driven element in this example, the 440 megacycle driven element becoming a short circuit on 2 meters, a quarter wavelength of 2 meters of cable back to the T connector would reflect an open circuit. So when you're on 2 meters, the 440 antenna at the T connector would be an open circuit. You can see that you can get automatic switching here. And the 2-meter antenna, unfortunately, is probably going to respond very nicely on 2 meters, and it might respond pretty well on 440, the third harmonic. So some of the signal will go there. There's another way. There is the possibility that the 440 antenna on 2 meters is an open circuit because it's not a folded dipole, but a real dipole. And now it represents an open circuit on 2 meters. And a half wavelength of cable will repeat impedance. So a half wavelength of cable from the 440 back to the T connector would again reflect an open circuit if it was a dipole-like. So there are ways of putting crafty lengths of cable in between a T connector and your two antennas where you can force the whole system to be a poor man's equivalent of a diplexer. Let me drop it. The Cadillac solution would be a diplexing filter. A diplexing filter is a black box with a common input connector, and inside is a pair of filters so that when a signal in the common connector is on 2 meters, the output is automatically directed only to the 2-meter output. And when it's on 440, it's automatically directed only to the 440 output. That's a diplexing filter. But not many people have one of those. It's not something you see advertised a whole lot. It's going to cost you a little bit of money. You could homebrew them. By now that you know that there is such a thing as a diplexing filter, I'm not positive, but I'm going to guess that the appropriate chapter of the AR Oil antenna book will have a schematic diagram of a diplexing filter for 440 and 2 meters. But by way of a T-connector, you can get there. Even if you didn't do any of the jazz that I'm talking about, of carefully adjusting impedances and cable lengths and whatever, and just put a T-connector feeding the two separate antennas, there's a 90% chance it'll work like a charm. If it doesn't, there's a step-by-step procedure you can find out exactly what's happening. There are various techniques by which you can find out what is the real impedance of each one of those antennas on the wrong frequency. And by properly adjusting cable lengths between that antenna and a T-connector, you can get the equivalent of a poor man's diplexing filter. Another approach is to simply run two pieces of transmission line, but I can tell that in this case he would like to not do that. So it's doable. I wonder if anyone else within the sound of my voice has had the problem of one transmission line feeding two separate antennas. Barry probably has done that. So if you guys would like to tell us, how did you solve the problem? Please speak up right now. K2RIW and the TechNet, we're listening. Maybe no one's on frequency right now who's actually done that. As I hold the microphone close to my earphones, I'm hearing some of the feedback. I wonder if I'm getting sound as if I've got a rig turned on somewhere, if you know what I mean. I think some of it's the change in the design of the repeater these days. So if you simply use a T-connector, nothing's going to explode. It's not going to blow up. Nothing bad's going to happen. And step by step, you can find out how well it's working and how to make it work better. Lots of guys have done it. It's very doable. It's not a perfect answer, but that's as much answer as I can give right now, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, if he had an MFJ antenna analyzer, he should be able to predict the response of the antennas with just a plain T-connector, and then if he exhibits a problem, he can make up his little half-wave or quarter-wave cable for that correction. That should work, no?
You're onto something here, John. He could go one step further to being a darn good scientist if he owns or can borrow an antenna analyzer, and he measures each individual antenna on the proper frequency and the improper frequency. In other words, he measures the 440 antenna on 440. Hopefully he'll get something like a 1.5 Iswart or better. That's good news. But when he measures the 440 antenna and measures its impedance on 2 meters, that's an extremely valuable piece of information. And vice versa. Take the 2-meter antenna and measure its impedance on 440. That piece of information, intelligently used, will tell you exactly how much cable to use back to the T-connector so you get the maximum switching action. So once he's got access to an antenna tuner, and I didn't say the mathematics of this is super simple. If it was a simple short and open, like I gave as an example, and then you decide to use either quarter wave or half wavelength of cable from the T-connector to that antenna, that's an ideal solution. Mother Nature is usually not that ideal. Will that 440 antenna really be a perfect short circuit on 2 meters? Of course not. It's going to be a little bit inductive. Therefore, the length of line you should use should be a little bit adjusted if you want the most ideal solution. So, gathering the information as to the real impedance of the antennas on each of the frequencies will tell you exactly where to go, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2WGB. Well, that's great news for him because I do believe he has access to an analyzer. I believe it's an MFJ. And if it works with the analyzer and it's sufficient, fine. If not, it should be a simple thing for him to make up a few cables and try different lengths until he gets it closer and closer as he goes. Of course, he has to go up and down. That's what it's all about. But, yeah, he has to use a single wire because of the conditions that are in this building that he's in. So I think he's going to have great success with that.
Very fine, John. Want to go on to the third one?
Yes. Now I have a dB, and he wants to know if they're in perfect phase and same amplitude, will he get 0 dB output? So now, given the breakdown of a different type of, he did not specify which coupler, maybe he has both, I don't know, but given the breakdown on how that works with resistive versus the inductive.
Yeah, this is an interesting problem, and it's got about three funny characteristics to it. If I had a perfect power divider, a so-called inductive or lossless power divider, from the common port to the two output ports, by the conservation of energy, I'm dividing the power. So I put 1 watt into the common port, my two output ports will each have half a watt, and hopefully they're in phase with each other. That's if it is a so-called lossless. You think it's got 3 dB of loss on each port. It does, but it's not real loss because by conservation of energy, it's halving the power to the two output ports. There's a more broadband kind of resistive power divider, which really has 3 dB of loss inside on top of the power division. So you put 1 watt into the common port, you get a quarter of a watt out of the two output ports. Half of the power is lost in the resistive network, and the other half is lost due to power dividing. So you get 6 dB of loss to the two outputs if it's a resistive power divider. You get 3 dB of loss if it's not. Now let's use it backwards. If I took the 1 watt input on a lossless power divider and I get a pair of half watt outputs, and now I feed it backwards. I take a pair of half watt signals, feed them into the two output ports. If they're in phase and equal in power, a pair of half watt signals would give me 1 watt out of the common port, but there's a couple of catches here. The average guy is creating two separate signals with two separate signal generators. Even if they are synthesized signal generators and the dial has 7 decimal places and to the nearest
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you're trying to combine a pair of signals on 146 megacycles, and you've got 6 or 7 decimal places that you can set on the synthesizer, and you think you've got them both dialed to exactly 146 megacycles, and you pour them into the two half-watt signals, you pour them into those two output ports, and you expect to get 1 watt out of the common port. You probably will not. And the reason for that is coherence. If your two synthesized signal generators were both operating from the exact same 10 megacycle reference oscillator, and they now have a common reference oscillator, so they're not only on the exact same frequency, but they're truly phase locked, yes, they will add. However, you could have frequency accuracy to 8 decimal places on your frequency synthesizer running on two separate reference oscillators, two completely frequency synthesized signal generators. And to 8 decimal places, they are accurate, which means there's 1 hertz of difference, 1 cycle per second of difference. That means when you combine the two, and you think is a perfect combination, you could say for half a second they're in phase and half a second they're out of phase, and that response keeps repeating every second. And now the so-called 1 watt output, you put your power meter there, and you're going to watch the needle dancing up and down once every second. So, two equal signal generators being summed, you've got to recognize the fact that you're doing a vector sum here, phase counts. And to make things really exactly the same in phase, they got to be from the same common reference oscillator. In the real world, you're likely to have 10 kilohertz of difference between the two, maybe even 1 kilohertz of difference between the two, so they're going in and out of phase 1,000 times per second. You won't even see your power meter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You won't even see your power meter waving up and down because it can't move that fast. If you put an oscilloscope there, you would see this this butterfly-like envelope on the screen if the scope could operate at that RF frequency. So putting things in phase is a peculiar characteristic. When they're really two sine wave signals
on slightly different frequencies, but you don't know that. And they are being added together into a perfect lossless power summing device. Because there's a difference in frequency, and they're spending half their time in phase and out of phase, things that add that way add in a power manner, they don't add in a voltage manner. And as such, a pair of half watts that are slowly sliding in phase into this power summing device, you expect to get 1 watt output. You'd get half a watt output. You're starting with a pair of half watts, and the sum port is going to give you half a watt. 0 dB of difference from either one. It'll look strange to you. If you can really phase lock them to 1 hertz of difference, and on an oscilloscope you slowly plot what's happening, during the time that they're in phase, you're going to get a pair of half watts will give you 1 watt during the instant they're in phase. During the instant the outer phase, you get nothing out. They're canceling. And all of it's going into the internal termination of your power dividing device. If it's an isolated power divider, it's got an isolating resistor inside. I'll explain that in a minute. And so, some of the time I'm getting full power adding, some of the time I'm getting nothing, and the average of those is a 3 dB loss from the ideal world, from a conservation of energy point of view. Now, one of the kinds of ideal, nearly ideal...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One of the kinds of power dividers that's nearly ideal is called a Wilkinson hybrid. A Wilkinson hybrid has a common port with a pair of 70-ohm cables coming from that common port internally. The two 70-ohm cables are each a quarter wavelength long, and the common ports, quarter wavelength cable number one goes to port number two, quarter wave cable number two goes to port number three. So you got a common port, I'm calling port number one, a pair of 70-ohm cables are connected to it, they're each quarter wavelength long, they each go to their own separate output. Between the two output ports, there's a 100-ohm resistor internally. When you're feeding it in the forward direction, put 1 watt into the common port, you'll get half a watt out of each of the two output ports in phase. No voltage appears across the 100-ohm resistor. There's no dissipation. It's a lossless device, except for the conservation of energy, half power going at each port. The nice thing about that one is those two output ports are thoroughly isolated. Put a signal into port number three, all by itself. Half of that power will come out of port number one, your common port. Half of the power will be dissipated into 100-ohm resistor. Nothing will come out of port number two. Those two output ports are thoroughly isolated from each other. And there are certain places in the RF world when you need that isolation. A Wilkinson hybrid does that. There are kinds of 2-to-1 power dividers that hams often build, a quarter wave matching transformer, quarter wave impedance inverting transformer, where you're trying to feed two antennas from one transmission line because you're building a phased array of two antennas. So you choose a 37-ohm piece of a cable that you've made by way of choosing pieces of copper tubing of just the right diameter. You set it a quarter wavelength long. You got one connector on one end, you got a pair of connectors on the other end. That is a 2-to-1 power divider. It'll properly feed the two antennas. That's the good news. It has no isolation. So, although in many circumstances that's good enough when feeding two antennas, there are some cases in the RF world when you want to be able to sum two signal generators. So, say for instance, I'm about to do a two-tone test on my receiver or my preamplifier, and I want to put into it these two, what I call two tones. One signal generator is set at 100 megs, other signal generator is setting at 101 megs, and I'm looking for the third order intermods at 102 and 99. I want to sum those two signal generators together in a way that keeps them thoroughly isolated from each other. Let me drop. Because when I'm doing a two-tone test, whether the two tones are coming from audio signal generators, and I'm testing the microphone circuit of a single sideband generator, transmitter, or if I'm putting two signals into a VHF receiver in this example, I want to make sure that the two signal generators are thoroughly isolated from each other, because if any of the signal from signal generator number one gets into signal generator number two, it will generate a third order intermod right there. If your instrumentation is generating the third order intermods that you're trying to test for a device in the test, it can give you some very confusing results. So in that example, to test the intermod distortion characteristics of a VHF receiver, you want to be using a kind of power divider that has isolation, and you want to test the amount of intermods from the signal generator itself before you plug it into the device in the test. Because if your signal generators are making intermods, and your device is making intermods, and now you look at the composite output, and now those intermods from two different sources are beating against each other, you can get some very confusing results. So you got to measure the quality of your instrumentation before you proceed with that test. Very similar to a smart guy doing a ohm meter test. He's got a resistor on the table, and he's picked up his ohm meter, and he wants to measure that resistor. From the old school days, the average guy will put the two probes together first, and the ohm meter better read something very close to 0 ohms before he proceeds with the test. Otherwise, he's vulnerable to bad contact on the lead back to the meter. It's got internal, frayed leads that he doesn't know about, or it's got a dead battery inside if it's an old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter, and so on. If it's a triplet or a Simpson, you want to make sure that the ohm meter is working correctly before you try to measure that resistor. So, in many cases...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In many cases, you've got to do a quickie test on your instrumentation before you proceed. In the case of a directional coupler you're using, you want to measure the directivity of the coupler before you proceed with the measurement. Otherwise, it could be very confusing. I know we're going off on a couple of tangents here, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. No, more information, the better. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of work. I have an idea for him. Maybe you have some comments on this. If he wants proof of concept and be able to test exactly what you're saying, if they are lossless and he has two of them, he could take a signal generator, a single one, put that into an input port, split that signal, 1 dB in, half a dB out, and then go into the combiner, and he can actually make those measurements and prove that he knows they're in phase if there's no phase shift in the couplers themselves. So that ought to be a test he could run and get some simple answers.
You said 1 dB and half a dB. I know you meant 1 watt and half a watt. Yes, and you got to make sure that everything is terminated in order for it to be a fair test. In other words, if I'm putting in a signal generator on the common port, and I'm going to measure what comes out of each of the output ports, you're going to be measuring the power out of each one of the output ports, but you got to make sure that the unused port is terminated. So I put the signal generator into my common port, I put my power measuring device into one of the output ports while the unused output port is properly terminated. Because in some cases, without proper termination, you'll get a confusing result. And so if he measures half the watts coming out, or 3 dB of loss, then it is a so-called lossless or ideal power divider. If he gets one quarter of the power output in watts, or a 6 dB loss, then most likely it is a so-called resistive divider. The good news of a resistive divider is it can be extremely flat, literally DC to light. In other words, a truly well-constructed resistive divider could be an ideal power dividing device that operates from 1 hertz up to 1,000 megahertz, for instance, whereas the ideal ones never are that broad. But that's the good news. The bad news is they've got another 3 dB of loss in a resistor divider. You pay your money, you take your choice. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. What I meant by that last construct, if he had two of them, he could use one to split the common signal, then go back into another combiner, identical, have the cover removed, and he could actually make measurements, and if he had 1 watt going into the first one, maybe he'll get 0.9 watts coming out of the second one. And that will give him a good point to make measurements, and he could probably work there. He could work backwards or forwards.
Yeah, I like that one, John. That's a good one. As long as he's using it within the frequency range that each one of them is rated for. So, the first one is a power splitter, directly connected to the second one, acting as a power summer. And I think he's going to measure even more than 0.9. He's going to measure 0.95. If he puts 1 watt into the first one, he might measure 0.96 watts out of the second, out of the second one. If they are both lossless type, if one of them is a resistive divider, then 1 watt into the first one is going to measure a half a watt out of the second one. If both of them are resistive dividers, 1 watt into the first one is going to measure a quarter of a watt out of the common lead of the second one. So there's a couple of different combinations there on the assumption that everything's in the right frequency range and everything's in phase. If he's using coaxial cables between the two output ports of the first one and the two input ports of the second one, you got to make sure that both of those cables are the exact same length. Otherwise, you're creating a phase shift that can create confusion. In the worst circumstances, if those two cables doing the summing into the second one are exactly a half wavelength different in length, then 1 watt into the first one could, in theory, give you 0 watts out of the second one. You can get a lot of different combinations here, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Dick, well, it sounds like he's an experimenter, and he can do that. Try different lengths of coax cables in between them, differential lengths, and see what the phase shift is, and notice how that attenuates the output of the final combiner. Great idea. Yeah, give him some more work to work on. That's about it from the mailbag, Dick. Back to you, sir.
Glad to hear that, John. Those are some good questions that you're getting. And what John does is he gets a whole lot of questions, and he selects the ones that he thinks that are most general in interest. I'm amazed. I'm hearing some television in the background of my house that normally is not heard here at the other end of the house. Somebody must have the setup awfully loud. Okay, the space report is now what John, here we go, what Paul's about to give us. I'm looking at the Thursday, October 11th issue of Newsday. On page A48, it talks about the private capsule delivers in space. It talks about the SpaceX and Dragon delivering 1,000 pounds worth of hardware. And then some number of days downrange, more than 2,000 pounds of hardware from the International Space Station are going to come back down. It's amazing. They're going to bring down more hardware than they brought up. Experiments and things that they want to discard. So the nice thing about the Dragon and the SpaceX, the new technique, is that the cargo ship does get recovered on the way home. It doesn't get burned up. And eventually it's going to be bringing astronauts back down, I believe. Let me drop. And another thing that happened interesting today is that around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, our time, the astronaut, I'm going to call him astronaut, he was supposed to jump out of a balloon-borne capsule at 120,000 feet, roughly 20 miles up, 23 miles up. He jumped out at 128,000 feet. He quite possibly did break the sound barrier, did a lot of tumbling at first. I hear tell that the heated-up visor, which was supposed to not fog up, did fog up. But it apparently was a pretty successful mission, so maybe you got some words on that one too, Paul. And Paul, give us a brief transmission to make sure that your signal is coming through before you proceed. WS2M, a space expert, K2LAW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Fine, this is 6, WS2N, space report. Yeah, Dick, how's that?
Unfortunately, tonight, Glenn, here we go, Wes, here we go, boy, John, Harry, Frank, let's see, Paul, I'll eventually get it, your
about 75% noise, 25% audio tonight. Maybe you should make a quick transmission on the 147.375 input to see if that sounds better, because quite a bit of noise tonight. Over to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, this should be pretty good. I'm a stone throw away from this repeater. I'll copy.
A tiny bit lower in audio, but you sound real good. So speak up a little bit and please proceed.
Okay, fine. Very good. The Dragon X, Space X program is really doing good company. Successfully docked with the ISS. Not automated system. It's not like the Progress or the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle system by the European Space Agency. Them and the Russians with the Progress autonomously docked with the space station. It's all automatic. And they go up near the station, maybe 30 feet away. And in this case, the commander, Sunita Williams, reached out with the robotic arm, grabbed the hold of the thing, and docked it with the Harmony node. And all went well. They depressurized. What happens is that thing is, it doesn't bring its own atmosphere up. It doesn't have oxygen. It's just a capsule, and they have to use the air from the International Space Station to pressurize this thing. After doing that, they opened the door, and they were able to get their supplies. About 875 pounds, I read. A couple of websites talking about 1,000 pounds, all of that, but according to the NASA site, it was 875, and then coming back down to over 1,300, and they have a lot of science equipment, things that they need to bring back, blood supplies, they run tests on people, and they need to get these tests back, and the only way back is this, is through the Dragon spacecraft. The Soyuz craft doesn't have enough room. They just have enough room for people.
Glad you dropped them. To reset the machine.
Only craft that returns. The other ones, like you said, burn up over the Pacific Ocean. So it's pretty good. It's reusable. They could take the same craft and blast back up into space at least 10 different times. So far, none of them have done that. They keep using new ones. And by the sixth flight, they're going to try to recover the Falcon 9 booster itself, the first one. And eventually, the second stage, they'd like to do they're going to do the first stage. And somewhere down the line, they'd like to recover the second stage. A lot more difficult. That one has to have a heat shield. They have to have telemetry and communications on board to get it back to where it's supposed to go. So, of course, the Dragon will eventually come back and land on solid ground with astronauts up to seven. Let me drop it. WS2N. So, very progressive company. They have contracts with other private companies. They launched a satellite when they went up for Orbcomm, I think it was. That's the company. They deal a lot of communications from machinery to machinery. For instance, the truck has to send up telemetry to let them know where they are. Things on a pipeline or maybe a locomotive. The machines communicating with other machines. Orbcomm does that. Well, SpaceX now has a contract with any of these small Orbcomm satellites. So they're going to deal with NASA. They're going to deal privately. They've got a contract for Iridium, an Iridium satellite. So they're doing okay. And they got big plans. They have a heavy lift vehicle that they plan on launching in a not too distant future. It's like taking two extra Falcon 9
stage one rockets and bumping them to the original one, and having 27 of these Merlin rockets blast off, creating like 3.8 million pounds of thrust. And with that, they could put big satellites up into geosynchronous orbit. Let me drop it. And even future plans, in fact, next year, or maybe even probably beginning of 2013, they plan on proposing to NASA. NASA has what they call the Discovery Program, which involves a lot of these Mars craft that have been going up to Mars, and they plan on offering their launch vehicle, the heavy Falcon, to send a rover to Mars for NASA in 2018. They call this one the Red Dragon, Dick. They've got all these names, you know. The Red Dragon is going to go to Mars and it'll do the EDL, you know, the entry, descent, and landing. No problem. They're going to use their retro rockets and they'll slow down with the heat shield. When they get close enough, they'll light their rockets off and they're just going to land. These are their plans. So it's a good company. What can I tell you? Let me drop. Yeah, on the deal with this Felix, I got his last name. We've talked about him on the net many times, but he's the guy that went up in that capsule. I wouldn't call it a gondola. I mean, it was a pressurized capsule that this guy was in. And Felix Baumgartner, 24 miles up, says he took a jump. He broke the record of Killinger. He was there. He was the communication link between the two. He was, I don't know, he's got to be 70 years old. And he went from like 109,000 feet, and this guy is up at 128,000. And one of the goals was to actually break the sound barrier, which I said he did. I heard on the news tonight, on TV news, over 800 miles per hour this guy got up to, so he did pretty good. Let me drop it. His visor was starting to fog up before he jumped, but they thought it was okay to do it, and he did it. He had a heater problem. In fact, he said his head was getting quite cold. He had a shot. And we talked about this. I mean, this was in a book, Preparing, or what was the name? Packing for Mars or something. It was in that book. This woman wrote all the stuff that would be involved in going to Mars, and talked about emergency ways of getting out of a spaceship. And they mentioned this Red Bull company and this guy, Felix Baumgartner, and he... years ago, and he's been practicing this for probably 5, 6, 7 years, getting ready for this particular jump. He's made other lower jumps, and today was the big day. He tried last week. High winds stopped him from doing it. The wind started pushing a balloon all over, and they called it off. So the Red Bull Company financed the whole thing. It doesn't even cost us a cup of coffee, Dick. We drop it. WS2N. Let's see if I have it. Okay. So, it's completely independently financed, but they are going to give the results from the spacesuit that this guy used to NASA. Will help. You know, it's going to help develop the spacesuits in the future. Theory going to that, you know, if you had to abandon somewhere up and out of space, rocket fails, and you know, you might be able to float all the way down to Earth with the system. Took the wrong way off from doing that, but I mean, this guy gave it a shot. It worked out okay for him. So I thought I'd mention that. There's about three other topics, Dick. I don't know if you want to cover them. back of that WS2N.
Sounds like that operation worked very well, Paul, for Felix Baumgarten. I'm looking right now at my copy of Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. It was published in 2010. And I'm kind of curious which chapter talks about Felix Baumgarten and his future attempt 2 years hence to jump out of a balloon-borne capsule from 120,000 feet. I didn't know that that was in there. That book, Packing for Mars, does give you a lot of the inside information about what it's really like being an astronaut. And it's not quite as glamorous as it sounds. There's certain portions behind the scenes that are very different than you would think. For instance, you guys have probably heard me say before that something like 50% of all the astronauts and 50% of all the cosmonauts, when they go into space, spend the first 24 hours barfing. They get space sickness. Their stomach just doesn't like weightlessness, and they get seasick, so to speak, but they call it space sickness, for the first 24 hours. Roughly half of all the astronauts and half of all the cosmonauts run into that problem. And this could be your third mission into space, where the first two times you didn't get sick and the third time you do. It's not predictable. And when you take these motion sickness pills and whatever, I think it helps a little bit, but not much. So that's just one of the many things that is not well advertised. Why don't you go through at least one of your other subjects, Paul, but what chapter in Packing for Mars talks about Felix Baumgarten or a similar-sounding mission? I just looked down the index page. I didn't see anything that sounds like that. I said index page. I looked at the chapter definitions in the beginning. And maybe there's an index out the back that's going to tell me something about it. No, I don't see an index out the back. So how did you find that in there? Back to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
I think I read that book about a couple of years ago, so I'll find the book and look through it. But yeah, they talked about this Red Bull company involved with this guy and mentioned his name. Don't know what part of the book, though. I'll have to go to my shelf and take a look at that. But definitely. She bought him up. And he was supposed to probably do it a year or two ago. I mean, maybe 3 years ago, I guess. I don't know. I lose track of time, Dick. And no, not much else. I just wanted to mention that the International Space Station crews in the not-too-distant future are going to switch from, well, some of them anyway, are going to switch from six-month flights. You know, they go up there and they hang out for 6 months and then they come back. Lately, that's the shuttle retirement, of course, on the Soyuz spacecraft. And now we're going to have one-year missions for some of these people. So they're practicing for longer-duration missions to eventually go out to the asteroids, to Mars, and they want to see how the body does. There have been like a half a dozen people that have done this, all Russians, that have lasted over a year. One guy's got a record for over 400 days on a Mir spacecraft. So they have approved that. That should be pretty good. They'll be using the SpaceX and eventually Orion and eventually Dream Chaser to send all these astronauts back and forth. And you do have a permanent crew of six people on board. So that's pretty good. So I wanted to mention that. That definitely will probably start within another year or so. The other thing I want to mention is these five ham satellites that were released by the International Space Station. They're all like CubeSats, you know, very small satellites. And they actually launched them by a robot on the Kibo module. Let me drop it. The Kibo module is the Japanese component of the International Space Station, which is actually the largest of all the different modules. It involves actually two modules, one big one about 30 feet long, and another one that attaches to the top of that, and that's you know, maybe half the size. And then they have a big outdoor porch with all these scientific experiments going on that need to be done out of space instead of in the inside environment of the space station. And a robotic arm. They have their own robotic arm. So with that, they launched five of these hand satellites a few days ago, I think beginning of the month, by different outfits, Ames Center, in collaboration with a Swiss company, and you know, a couple of universities launched one. Another one was launched by Japan, some college or some kind of technology center. So you can get the list. A lot of people get these emails on the, you know, from the ARRL, and that's where I got this. From, you know, a lot of people will. There's so much that comes through. I don't know if you might delete it by accident, but there's a list of five of them, by the different organizations and colleges that put these things together. We dropped. Looks like, from what I see, they're all like just testing something. They're not really. I don't see any uplinks to them. A lot of them are digital, like an AX.25. On 437.465. So a lot of it's telemetry, and they're looking for people that hear these things. Another group is experimenting. They're going to be sending down 4.84 gigahertz. They want to see how that works out. So you know, look into the live sats, ham sats that were sent up if you're interested. Like they're all just transmitters of some sort. That's pretty much it, Dick. I just wanted one other thing. In the future, let me drop it. You know, what might help Space Agency and get people a little bit more enthused, the general public. Some people, I mean, I remember years ago telling people that, you know, another shuttle was doing this, you know, launching that, or you know, walking on the Hubble Space Telescope, and they would say, oh, it's up there again, you know. I mean, people just don't think about this stuff. And this will probably make the news. This singer, I don't know if you've ever heard this singer, Sarah Brightman. Very good, extremely good voice on this lady. She always wanted to go up into outer space. Now that she's, I'm sure, a multimillionaire, she's able to afford a ride onto the Soyuz spacecraft. So after her singing tour ends at the beginning of next year, she's going to go over to Star City, which is near Moscow. That's where all the cosmonauts train, drive it. She's going to train to get on that spaceship and get shot up to the International Space Station. And she'll get to be a singer. She's going to sing from the International Space Station. I mean, if this doesn't make the news, I mean, your regular Channel 2, 4, 5 news, you know, nothing will. She's got an incredible voice, and that should be really very interesting. That would be very publicized. She'll be the eighth tourist following her group of people, like Dennis Tito was the first, and this guy Mark Shuttleworth from South Africa, I think he was second, half a dozen more people after that. She'll be number eight. So thought I'd mention that as well. Back to you, Dick. WS2N Space Report, TechNet.
Question, Dick?
Go right ahead, John.
KC2WGB. A little off topic, but it is in the news, the military news. Does anybody know what happened to the missile cruiser or destroyer that T-boned one of our submarines off the East Coast? I heard the news flash.